Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Friday, May 17th, 2019. My name is Daniel Bader. I am the managing editor of Android Central. And if you are listening to this, you have been inundated with AC podcast episodes in the last couple of weeks, so lucky you. And on all of those shows, on all of them, even the one that I wasn't on, was this man I'm joined by today, Andrew Martinick. How are you, dude?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you very much. It's been a whirlwind of podcasts from different cities, different topics, some under embargo, some not. But now we're kind of back to a somewhat regular situation, except for it's just the head-to-head podcast today.
Yeah, just the two of us. We had a bunch of people who we wanted to invite on the show, and they all said no. They just said, no, we don't like you. So it's just the two of us. We are the only people left in the world who like one another enough to do this show, Andrew.
Very fair.
All right. So first, because we're all one big happy family, and I don't want to leave this too far along into the show. Congratulations to Joe Maring and Kennedy Weston, our dear friends and coworkers at Mobile Nations, who are getting married today. So this podcast goes out to you. I hope it's an amazing, amazing evening and celebration. All right. This show is a bit of a hodgepodge, Andrew. I think we'll touch on a lot of the things we've already talked about, but we've had some time to digest a few of the more immediate announcements: Google I/O, Pixel 3a, OnePlus 7 Pro.
Finally reflect a little bit.
Yeah, we'll just slow it down, take some time. The whole show on Tuesday was dedicated to the 6T or to the 7 Pro. But now we have a bit more context. So we know more about the OnePlus 7. We know more about launch details in other countries. And we've just spent more time with the 7 Pro itself. So let's dive in there and I guess talk about it. How are you feeling about this phone a week later?
Still feeling really good. I want to say that it always feels good when you get, everybody can open up about their experiences, after whatever the embargo lifts, things like that. The public starts to chime in. And I think that everything we talked about on Tuesday was really validated by everybody else. Of course, there are differences of opinion here and there, but it still feels like it's still a fantastic value, even though the price is higher than some, would have expected from coming from the 6T. I haven't found any, like gotchas or caveats or anything like that. We had a good amount of time with the phone before the review came out, well over a week and a half. So I was already feeling really good about that. I think the only thing that I'm still kind of trying to convey to people is that I'm just not super stoked on the camera. And I think additional days have kind of continued me down that path.
I found it really interesting. We obviously talked internally about the phone a lot before the embargo lifted, and the performance was second to none. Nobody questioned that at all. But we had a lot of differing opinions on two things: the camera and the battery life. And
yeah,
that came down to personal experience. And it was interesting being validated on both ends when I saw other reviews. A lot of, Marques Brownlee, The Verge, Engadget, our buddies at places like TechRadar, Digital Trends, Android Police, Android Authority, like they all had similar kind of conclusions to me, is that the camera was good most of the time, but it didn't blow anybody, even the Galaxy S10, out of the water.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work that OnePlus needs to do on processing.
Yeah, it really I think that's the exact thing. It has, especially in the case of the main sensor, the main camera sensor and lens, it has all the tools, but it feels like it's going through the same photo processing as the 6T. It really doesn't feel like anything has changed there other than throwing new hardware at it. And so, of course, you get a little bit of an advantage there. It definitely takes better photos. But when it can't even, like, there's no part of the camera experience where you go, wow, this is better than something else that's happening with the Galaxy S10 even, or the and definitely not the Pixel 3 or Huawei P30 Pro. So, which is something that's weird because everywhere else in the phone, you can point to little things that are as good or in many cases better than these other phones. And of course, there are shortcomings to balance those out. But in the camera arena, everything across the board feels like it comes up short of the competition.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I go back to the diversity. We talked about this on Tuesday, but I talked about, you know, the diversity of options, right? Every phone that you buy these days, except for the Pixel, it seems, gives you that diversity of shooting options. You have, you know, ultra wide all the way through to 3x telephoto on the OnePlus 7 Pro. You have that similar loadout on basically everything. It may be, you know, 2x telephoto or 3x, but most phones today have those three options in that price range. All three of those cameras are just not as good as they should be, in my opinion. But at the same time, how much, like, how high do we have to hold them to that same standard as a $999 Galaxy S10 Plus?
Yeah, that's always so tough.
It's difficult, right? Like, do they get a pass because they're charging significantly less, even though they are saying in the marketing and the, you know, the fans and everything are putting it in the same category, and they're clearly pricing the phone much higher than they did last year.
And it's, and the tough part about it is the camera, especially the main camera. I mean, I'm really not happy with the wide and telephoto, but especially the main camera, it's nice LaCroix open there. I was a professional and opened my LaCroix before the episode started, Daniel. The interesting thing is that it's tough to talk about the cameras because you want to hold them to a higher standard, but at the same time, they're fine. It's not that they do a bad job. It's just that you notice when you, especially when you put them side by side with something like the P30 Pro or the Galaxy S10 or the Pixel 3 at night, you say, well, yeah, it's not good enough. But taken on their own, yeah, I got by just fine. And now that the review period has ended, I'm still using the OnePlus 7 Pro. If the camera was not, you know, was not good enough in any respect, I would have already switched away because the camera is so important to me. So it really does feel like you're nitpicking a little bit. And I pointed this out in the review that the reason why I think we're a little more justified in nitpicking on this phone is that, like you said, the marketing is putting it on an even higher pedestal. The price is putting it on a higher level. And everything else about the phone is so great and so comparable to these other phones that are $200 or $300 more that, yeah, you probably should, you know, be able to hold the cameras up to that standard too.
Yeah, I would agree to that. I also, you know, for me, it's the camera is perfectly usable, and I've reviewed all of the photos that I've taken over the last couple of weeks, and they're great. They're fine, but I haven't found any that I super love. And every time I have a Pixel 3 next to it, I always prefer the Pixel 3. I mean, it's just a fact, and I can't help it. And I'm sorry to all the fans who hate me right now, but that's just true. I prefer the way that Pixels produce photos. And it's funny, like, I was just sort of on a tangent, a diversion a little bit, but I was going back through photos I took when I traveled to Barcelona for MWC last year, and to right after that I went to South Africa with my wife, and I was taking photos with the Pixel 2 there, and I was looking back on Google Photos through those photos, and they're so good. I mean, like, I look at those, and I wasn't sure. It's just some I took with the DSLR, and others I took with the Pixel 2, and there were so many times where I'm like, I don't know what camera I used this for until I pressed I and looked at the information. And it goes to show just how good that Pixel 2 and how much better it was over the original Pixel. The Pixel 3 is a small, like you mentioned in your review, it's a pretty minor improvement over the Pixel 2. But it was really that Pixel 2 that that cemented the brand as the best camera you can buy by far.
And compared to the competition, at that time, it was way, way, way ahead. You know, obviously, since then, the Pixel 3 is still great, but you know, some of the competition has caught up a little bit too. But yeah, man, back then is just insane.
So anyway, I mean, not like kind of besides the point, but the one thing I would like to say as well about the OnePlus is, over the last week or so, as I've had it in my pocket, I enjoy using it less and less because it is so big and it is so heavy. And I just want to go back to phones that don't weigh as much as a brick. Like I told you earlier, I would pay almost as much as I would for the Pixel for the OnePlus 7 Pro for a phone that was 25% lighter or smaller. Like, it just,
yeah, we were having this discussion over, you know, how much, like, where's the threshold of how much lighter you need this phone to be before you before you'd be okay with it.
Totally. And it makes a big difference, right? Even putting the Galaxy S10 Plus in your pocket, which is as big, the weight just has so much bearing. And it's you don't realize it because it's not like it's weighing down your pocket, but it just makes kind of everyday, like those repetitive movements, the way that you hold the phone, it makes a big difference. And it's something that you don't realize every gram matters. It's weird. Like you don't think about it, but it's true. Every gram in a phone matters. OnePlus just kind of went a little overboard this year.
Yeah, I've surprisingly not had as much of an issue with the size and weight because I was just using a Galaxy S10 Plus before, which it's definitely still bigger and heavier than that, but it's not way off board. But it is refreshing whenever I pick up something else. I did comparisons this week to the Galaxy S10 Plus, the OnePlus 6T, and hilariously the Galaxy S10e, and you know, setting it next to an S10e is just absolutely hilarious. It's 40% heavier than a Galaxy S10e.
And let's talk about that for a second, because you know, you're sort of, it's not fair almost to put the Galaxy S10e in the same category as the OnePlus 7 Pro, but from a pricing perspective, the cheapest Galaxy S10 is the most in line with the OnePlus 7 Pro of
the most
any
expensive
of the Galaxy
OnePlus
flagships.
7 Pro.
Right. So you're talking $750 for the OnePlus 7 Pro with 12 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of storage, which is more powerful than the Galaxy S10e, but not by much. I mean, it's still Snapdragon 855. You get 6 gigs of RAM in the S10e rather than 12. So that's the major difference. You only get two cameras on the back on the Galaxy S10e instead of the three on the 7 Pro. But at the same time, they're in the same price bracket and they're going after the same customers to some extent, a little bit. There's some crossover. So I wonder, you know, when you compare the two, you compare the strategy, Samsung's strategy seems to be working this year. You have, we have reports that the S10 line is selling considerably better than the S9 line at the same period last year. Obviously, there's an extra phone, but all three phones are more expensive than the S9 last year, right? If you remember,
yeah,
the S9 started at $729. So what's happening here? Is it just the regular cycle of the TikTok refresh kind of thing, or is there something else going on?
Oh, that's always tough to tell. I mean, in the case of the S9 to S10, I mean, we really, and I don't think it was just us, I think everybody talked about how much of a kind of warmed over refresh the S9 was from the S8. And we always talk about these big, so with Samsung, the even numbers are the bigger moves for them. When you think about the I mean, go back two generations from that, if we still think about two-year refresh cycles. The S6 was the big redesign that caught everybody's attention. S7 refined it. The S8 was then all new technology from the S7. The S9 was kind of a refresh. And then the S10 was a bigger thing. And so from that perspective, it makes sense. And the, you know, as we know, price matters, but at the high end, it doesn't matter nearly as much. They can go up by $120 and it's basically nothing. People just don't really care in the grand scheme of financing phones. And when they relieve some of their own price pressure with the S10e, they really just kind of solve that problem anyway, and they still get to up the average selling price.
So this brings me to the OnePlus 7 Pro's partnership with T-Mobile. When we recorded the podcast last week to be published on Tuesday, we didn't know the details, the pricing, and the variant that T-Mobile would stock. We now know that it's only the $700 variant, which is the one that, you know, consequently you recommend to most people. Yeah. It's the one that has 8 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of storage. What do you think about that decision and the decision for OnePlus to really, or T-Mobile to really, really go heavy on this? They've done a lot of marketing, a lot of publicity around this. There's a lot of hype, especially since it's just one phone with one size variant, really.
Yeah, I mean, so the going with one version, the one SKU, makes a ton of sense. There's really like the market for the 12 gig of RAM one with no additional storage is very, very minimal. That's just something OnePlus can do direct to consumer for the, you know, for the fans. And from T-Mobile's perspective, they want to, you know, they don't want to stock two different variants. And usually the reason to, you know, have that lower end model is to, you know, get people in the door and then upsell. So when the only difference in price is $30, they think, let's just stick with the one model. Now, going at it hard, I'm not surprised. There are very few true carrier exclusives nowadays. It used to be such a huge deal, and it makes sense from OnePlus and T-Mobile's perspective to try to go really hard, because they have a phone that they can say is exclusive to T-Mobile, even though we know, of course, you could just go buy it on OnePlus.com. But they're bound to put lots of marketing behind it, because it's an easy sell on a financing plan that's going to be, you know, still, of course, $150, $200 less than some of the competing phones that they're selling. And they can say you can't get it anywhere else, and there's a little bit of cachet to that.
And the other thing is, OnePlus doesn't offer a financing solution. They have implemented
like a third party thing, right?
They do have that, and then they have a trade in program for the first time now, where you get only $380 for a OnePlus 6T, which is kind of crazy to me that you only get that. But I guess the phone was only $549, so that doesn't sound like. It sounds like a little, like a low amount, but it's actually not. You're getting more than 50% of its value. Anyway, you can get it for $0. And T-Mobile loves the idea of being able to say that you pay under $30 a month for this phone, which you can't really say for a lot of flagships anymore. We'll talk about the Galaxy S10 5G on Verizon a bit later. That is double the cost per month. Yeah. It's like $54 a month, which is insane. So, yeah, this is definitely attractive to T-Mobile. Let's kind of round this conversation up. Round it out. The one thing that I want to say is we didn't know exactly what they would be doing with the 6T and the 7. The 7 is basically a slightly upgraded 6T, and it'll be available in parts of Europe and Asia for around 499 euros or 499 pounds. And
very boring.
It's a bit boring. It's got the same flaws, like the real, really, real big flaws as the 6T, including terrible haptics, the same camera, the same
display.
Okay display, nothing great. but it has the Snapdragon 855. It's got UFS 3.0 storage. So
same main camera, but the the 7 Pro's main camera,
yeah,
but the 6T's wide angle camera.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure why they decided to do what they did there and then keep the 6T at a $30 discount in North America. But
yeah.
I guess they have inventory to deplete, and once they do that, then they'll just sell the 7 Pro.
Yeah.
It is a kind of a strange decision.
It's also, yeah, it wasn't quite it's not what we expect, right? From the, we were just talking about the Galaxy S10 series. The S10e is very much an S10. Like they made cuts where it needed to be cut for the size. And it's very much an S10 in terms of function and the cameras and capabilities and everything, display quality. Whereas the 7, it just isn't. I mean, it's not false advertising, but it's basically just slightly changed 6T with the components that they already had laying around, which is a little bit of a disservice to people that may not know what they're getting into. They may see the 7 and 7 Pro pitched together, you know, as this 1-2 punch kind of thing, and you can get the more expensive one or the cheaper one, when really they're not cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, it is. It's very much a warmed over 6T. Like, no question about that. It seems like they really didn't try at all. But at the same time, they needed to still hit that lower price point.
Yeah.
And they probably, I think what happened was they realized that the only way into the US market in any meaningful scale was through the carrier, and the only model that the carrier wants is the more expensive one that they can finance.
And to their credit, they really didn't hype the 7. Like, the 7 just came out.
Well, the 7 wasn't even mentioned at the North American launch.
Right.
Period.
So they, you know, the Pro was the thing, and so that's, you know, so there is that. They didn't do one of these things where they go, and the OnePlus 7 series starts at 499 euros or something. They just focused on the 7 Pro, which was the right thing to do.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing if OnePlus can fix some of the camera processing bugs in software updates. I've already received 2 updates since I received the phone, and that's really welcome considering just how few updates we get from other devices. So the last thing I want to talk about is battery life, because I've had really good battery on the 7 Pro. I know you've had decent battery. I know, you know, Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, had really good battery life, and yeah, Alex conversely had terrible battery life. So this is another thing where I see a lot of different opinions on.
Yeah, I land somewhere between, I think I'm a little bit closer to you. I'm definitely not seeing what Michael Fisher was seeing. He was seeing really solid battery life. I've just found that anytime I need to spend a good amount of time with the screen on, the battery just falls off a cliff. And all other times, it's totally fine. And, you know, you're kind of more typical usage where the screen's not on for very long and you're not really hitting it hard, it'll end the day just fine. And, you know, and then 2 days ago, I charged at like 7 o'clock because I was at 10%. So it's more just the variety that's a little bit disconcerting, and just the fact that we're used to so much better from a OnePlus phone. That's kind of my only issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think inconsistent is the word that I would use. The experience just seems to be extremely inconsistent. Most people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think that's not a big problem. It's definitely not as good as, say, the Galaxy S10 Plus, but very few phones are. So
yeah.
Let's take a quick break and thank our first sponsor, Audible. I'm super happy to have Audible as a sponsor, Andrew. I don't know about you, but I actually listen to a lot of Audible content already, and I think it's really interesting that we've kind of gotten to this point where when you go out for a walk or you have an opportunity to listen to something in your ear, you have three options these days. You have music, you have podcasts, and then you have audiobooks. And increasingly, I'm listening to audiobooks through Audible.
And the interesting thing about audiobooks is a lot of people are craving this type of really well-produced, well-spoken content from podcasts, and not all podcasts are like this. So
yeah, definitely, you know, not.
This is a good way
included.
To go.
Not the greatest. We're doing our best, but we're certainly not like Jim, we love you. You're amazing, but it's all on us.
Yeah, the problem is us.
When you talk about an audiobook from Audible, you're talking about like professional productions with sound effects and actors and all this stuff. You know, there are real like people, Rachel Hollis, Dave Goggins, Mel Robbins. These are people who are doing this for a living. And Audible members now for your monthly fee get way more than before. You can choose three titles every month, one audiobook plus two Audible originals. The Audible original series is kind of this magical thing. It's sort of like a podcast, but they're a little bit more professionally produced, and they just have some really interesting things. I've been listening to The Beautiful Brain, which is a four-part Audible original, and it's just all about how our brain is this like amazing thing that has all of these unknown aspects that, you know, science, neuroscience is still trying to understand. And that comes free with your Audible subscription. I've also been listening to, you know, speaking of brain, I've been listening to How to Change Your Mind, which is a book by Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma. And it's really about the exploration of psychedelics in medicine. And before the early 1960s, psychedelics were part of the kind of the, not mainstream, but they were a much more accepted part of psychology. And once they were deemed to be dangerous, if abused, they were outlawed. And only now has it slowly become less verboten to integrate it into professional settings. And Michael Pollan writes about this from a science perspective. He's not going crazy taking LSD and mushrooms. He's approaching the history of this. He's really doing a great job. And that's just one of thousands of books that you can get through Audible. So if you're interested in an Audible trial, 30-day trial, and your first audiobook plus two Audible originals for free, you can go to audible.com/ACP. Or if you're technical like us, you can text ACP to 500-500. That's audible.com/ACP. Or text ACP to 500-500, and you can get your first audiobook free plus two Audible originals. And thank you so much, Audible, for sponsoring. This is one of my favorite services, and I'm really happy. Okay, Andrew, let's talk a little bit about some news that we heard from Samsung this week. Samsung, as we know, had some problems with the Fold.
Heard of that,
talked about that. Now we know what the company's done, and it's not surprising, but
it's
we have
things
some
that I'm like, oh my God, how did they not do this before they shipped the thing the first time? Because they're so obvious.
Totally. And this report comes out of Korea, where we have a pretty comprehensive look at what they're doing to prevent the Fold's issues from recropping up. All right, so let's go through them. The first one was the screen protector that people
like to layer.
Tear off. It wasn't a screen protector. What are they doing for that?
So they're actually going to make it. So when you look at a photo of the Galaxy Fold, you'll see that there's this big raised up bezel that goes around the entire side. And the weirdest thing about the Fold when you first saw it was that this protective layer didn't go all the way to the edge. It wasn't even close. There was plenty of room to, as many people did, dig a fingernail in there and peel the thing off. And it never really made sense that that layer didn't go up to or underneath that bezel because it's never supposed to be removed. Now it's supposed to be actually tucked underneath that bezel, which seems like that solves a majority of this problem, because not only does it mean that the user is not going to think to remove it, but also it's fewer points for dust and things to get underneath, which is the other part, is that they're saying that the gap between the display and the body has been reduced. So there's these points at the top and bottom where the hinge is, where there's no bezel, and there's a gap there happening between the body of the phone and the screen. They say that that's even smaller. Again, just fewer points to get, you know, dust and little things in.
Yeah, the reason that they did it in the first place was apparently to make it easier to repair. And I guess I laud that, given that this is going to be a very difficult phone to repair anyway.
Yeah, I guess.
But you gotta you know, do better from a quality control perspective, or figure out systems internally to both make the phone easier to repair, but also not completely, not sort of trick your customer into thinking that it's potentially something that it's not. I mean, it didn't occur to me, and I don't think it occurred to you to remove that protector, but
it did not.
It was never made very obvious. And yes, we knew that the retail units were going to ship with a warning, but it's so easy to just try to pick off anything that resembles a screen protector. This was just a bad decision. And they had so much time to workshop this. Like, they could have done so much more research into consumer behavior that they didn't do.
Exactly. It's just, it's clearly, so it's tough because there are the two problems. Like, even when the screen protective layer is in place, there are still issues, and clearly they're trying to address those as well. But the consumer aspect is, I would say, it's the lowest hanging fruit. Like, don't make the phone in a way that the simplest way to take the phone out of the box to start using it would involve considering peeling that thing off, especially when you already have this big bezel around it. They can laser cut these pieces of plastic to any size within fractions of a millimeter. There's zero reason why that should, you know, why it should be the case that there is a notable gap on all of the sides. It also just looks bad. So if they could make it look better at the same time, it's win-win.
I mean, iFixit has tools that get underneath these screen protectors, or these different, they can quickly open phones using sprudges and glue, you know, hot glue guns or whatever they use. I mean, they have the tools. Samsung should have those tools. It's just not a question. It's pretty embarrassing. Anyway, so that's going to be fixed. And the next thing, which I, you know, would argue is even more important, is that they have found a way to mitigate debris from getting into the hinge. But I have no idea how they're going to do that without actually making the hinge less either reliable or more or adding friction to the hinge itself.
Yeah, this feels like a much more considerable design change. I mean, you could easily see them changing that protective layer process. That's something that happens, you know, when that top bezel goes on. But I'm not sure. I mean, of course, they can change tolerances a little bit, but I feel like they can't change it enough to completely mitigate the amount. I mean, there's a lot of room at both ends of that hinge, and it's integral to the way that the phone works, of course, that there just isn't a lot of additional tolerance that can be taken out of that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. And, you know, this, we were discussing when the phone was delayed initially, whether it would require a complete redesign, which would push it months late, or whether, you know, what I think they're going to try to do is basically just, like, what it amounts to, like, is stuffing stuffing paper or something equivalent to like, you know, sticky putty into that.
Yeah.
Into
the hole. Kind of reminds me of, there are good examples in the car world actually, because we always find examples in the car world where early models will come out and they'll have like a creak or a shake or a rattle or something somewhere in the interior. And they just slipstream something into the process to just like throw a bunch of foam tape on the back of those pieces or put a bunch of sound deadening in the back of it rather than actually fixing the problem. And then they just continue to ship the cars and nobody's, you know, we're none the wiser.
But what's really interesting is that those kinds of fixes are often pretty reliable if they're done properly at scale. You know, they don't necessarily impede the production process. And then next time you fix it and you find a much more permanent way to do that. There was an episode of The Daily. It's a New York Times podcast where they were discussing the issues that Boeing was having with production. It centered around the 737 MAX aircraft, obviously, but they were talking more as well about the Dreamliners and how when they first were made, there were a lot of issues that customers never saw because they were production issues that were in the more engineering areas, you know, in the holds, in the cabinetry, the places that customers would never go. But when they were inspected, they found all of these corners that were cut. And there's this question of, if this is discovered, these quality assurance people discover the problems, does it pose a health risk? Does it pose an actual long-term risk of malfunction, right? Like, for example, there were a bunch of tools left near circuitry that if dislodged could potentially break, dislodge wires or cut them or whatever. And that could cause a really big problem inside the aircraft. That obviously hasn't happened. There have been no reported issues with any 787 Dreamliners that were reported in the podcast and from what I've read. But it is interesting that, you know, when you're building stuff at scale, I mean, an aircraft is a completely different story, right? Obviously, than a phone. But yeah, it's the same idea, is that when you cut corners and you're doing things at scale, these decisions linger and the repercussions linger as well.
And it is an interesting comparison because it's just top of mind with the 737 MAX is when the exact same thing is going to happen when the fold comes back and when the plane comes back. It's going to be scrutinized like no product has ever been scrutinized in that area before, because we have the exact same product ostensibly coming back and you know exactly what caused the problems before. And so now what is everybody going to do? They're going to try to find the flaws and they're going to try to find the next problem. They're going to try to find the problems that were created by the fix. You know, we were talking about the hinge changing or something like that. And it's just, it's almost impossible for Samsung to come back and not have a second round of some sort of problem. If they chose, you know, it seems like they're going with the route of not redesigning the thing and just kind of doing more of the, you know, balance between effort and time. And I just don't know if they're going to be able to make enough of the changes to keep it out of the news cycle in short order after it comes back out.
Yeah, I think people will obviously find ways to break the fold. It's literally a folding phone. There will be lower tolerances. And this kind of brings us to another conversation that I wanted to have around the move to a more mechanical way of building phones, right? Where you have moving parts, and it's this week alone, we have the OnePlus 7 Pro with its mechanical front-facing camera that's rated for 300,000 movements, 150 selfies a day for 5 years is the math that OnePlus gave us, which is insane. And then there's the Asus Zenfone 6, which has a flip camera. So it has no front-facing camera at all, but instead when you want to use the camera in the front, it literally flips over and kind of like, hello, and just like peekaboos right up on top of the phone. If you haven't seen Alex's hands-on with this, it has a great GIF showing you exactly that. And it's impressive. I mean, the amount of engineering that goes into these things is considerable, but it does open up a lot more potential for failure. And we've talked about this in the past where, you know, you want, these are products that have, or until recently had, very few moving parts. And we even saw a trend where some experimental phones had no buttons at all. Like no, we moved from real buttons to capacitive buttons, no ports, nothing, where you remove the points of failure almost entirely. It does seem like we're now swinging in the complete opposite direction.
And it's interesting because we do have a couple of companies that are showing off these concept phones with zero ports, no openings other than a hole for a microphone. And those don't seem to be as well received as some of these new phones that do add actual utility by having a pop-up camera that removes the notch, or a flip-over camera that also removes the notch and gives you better selfies because it's using the same high-quality cameras. I just don't think that... I understand why people are worried. There's a big difference between having a pop-up camera and having a phone that folds in half. Obviously, they're part of the same idea of mechanical movements and devices that have, in recent history, been 100% solid state, except for OIS modules. But there's a big difference between those two things. I think that the pop-up camera or the flip-over camera or some kind of any kind of other small motorized part, yeah, it's like those are gonna fail at some point, maybe faster than solid state will. But I think those are engineering problems that are easily solved for, you know, to the point where you don't have to worry about them in the same way that, you know, the Galaxy Fold has all of its problems. I mean, the only recent example that I can think of is when you look back a few generations at Apple phones, when I think, what did it stop? It stopped with the 7. They went to a fake home button that didn't actually move.
Right.
So before that, it was 100% guaranteed that your home button on your iPhone was going to break. It was just a matter of time. It just, you know, did it happen after a year, 2 years, 3 years? That home button was eventually going to break, and you were going to have to turn on accessibility mode and put the little on-screen home button. And Apple figured that out, that was our last moving part in the phone, and it was time to get rid of that. And of course, they went to the fake one and then to none at all, which is the thing that, you know, Android phones figured out a few years prior. But these things are not as integral to the phone experience as something like a home button. And that's why I don't think you have to worry about it as much.
That's fair. And also, like, you're not physically pressing something hundreds of times a day.
Yeah.
You know, I do miss that tactility of, say, the Galaxy S7 having a physical home button. And I still sometimes actually miss that.
I like the alert slider on the OnePlus phones.
Yeah. And these are good examples of there's a satisfaction when you have a product that requires tactility. And I've heard, you know, it's interesting. You know, you're a car guy, and I've heard a few people talking about how one of the downsides to owning a car like a Tesla is that there are so few physical switches. There's so few knobs and buttons that you have to press. Everything is done through this central touchscreen interface, which is really good and intuitive, and a lot of people really like it, but it removes that tactility, and we're moving further and further away from the physical aspect of driving. I mean, autopilot isn't a replacement for driving, but it is becoming something where you can spend less time focusing on the act of driving, right? And I guess with phones, as they've moved to these more monolithic glass screens with very little bezel, no buttons, nothing to get in the way of the experience, I find it interesting now that we're sort of coming full circle, adding more mechanics, adding more complexity, especially around the camera, which is by far the most important feature to most people.
And yeah, the car analogy is kind of, it's kind of there, if only because phones have gone solid state because there isn't as much of a necessity for being able to quickly figure things out without looking at the phone. Whereas, you know, we have the situation in the cars is, you know, maybe just a completely flat screen doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're going 80 miles an hour down the freeway and, you know, you need to be able to reach over and touch something, you know, and know that there's a knob or a button or something or that you can handle a multitask. But phones, there's a lot more flexibility in where you use that mechanical nature. So when we're talking about using it for things that are not necessary but do have a design benefit, you know, we're mostly talking about getting rid of a notch on a display, and also, you know, protecting the front facing camera, things like that. What we're not yet really talking about is removing buttons altogether. We're still using buttons. We're still using ports. So those kind of physical things are sticking around. So it is interesting to see it reintroduced in phones for kind of vanity things rather than functional things.
Well, I mean, I'd argue that eventually ports will disappear. I don't know about buttons. Buttons are, I think that there's a compromise.
HTC will tell you that it didn't work out very well.
We know why it didn't work, because it was bad. But there were, you know, there have been other phones from companies like Meizu and Vivo this year. They've been experiments and they haven't been mainstream products, but they get rid of ports entirely and or get rid of buttons entirely. I do think eventually we will have portless phones. I know that companies like OnePlus have shied away from putting wireless charging because it adds cost and complexity, but eventually wireless charging will be resonant, and it won't require you to have your phone on a very small pad that may or may not charge it, depending on how accurately you put it on. I'm not talking in the next year or two. I'm talking about maybe 5-10 years from now, it'll be ubiquitous. But I do think that we are definitely moving in that direction. I do find it interesting that if you look down the road, phones, there's very little else that you can do, right? We've done away with the bezels. We figured that out for the most part. But all phones will have to have a screen. They will have to have cameras. They will have to have a way to convey sound. And sound is the thing, right? You see phones like the Huawei Mate or P30 Pro and the LG G8 mm-hmm. using the display itself as a resonance chamber, pushing sound through the translucent glass or orally transparent glass, as opposed to having an earpiece. So we figured that out. Are we going to figure out how to get rid of a speaker on the bottom entirely and just go completely resonant? I don't think so. It probably won't sound as good, but maybe that's the next vanguard. I didn't see mechanical cameras becoming a thing, at least not as quickly as they did. So this is interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think that that's the way you talked about the speaker is a good point, that you're just going to see these types of little things come through one at a time, and it's going to kind of sneak up on us, and then eventually we're going to see phones with lots of these different features altogether, rather than kind of, you know, the OnePlus 7 Pro is all solid state except for it has the pop-up camera, or the G8 is totally, you know, normal and nothing else is crazy about it, and then it has this display speaker, or, you know, on and on and on. You're just going to see little things here, and you're not going to see just this random jump to all of a sudden one phone integrates all these things.
I mean, look at the rumors around the Galaxy Note 10 and how that every single rumor that we've seen about that phone does not show it with the hole punch display that Samsung has only used once for one generation with the Galaxy S10. It does away with the bezels entirely, and we have renders or concepts of a slide down screen where you slide the phone down or up to show the cameras behind the screen, which I don't think Samsung would ever do. Mm-hmm. But they've also shown that the Galaxy A series with the Galaxy A80 does have that pop-up camera, the mechanical camera, and that's become a pretty popular phone. So I don't know. I mean, Samsung could be the one that does it next. And if Samsung does it, right, then that immediately becomes mainstream.
And yeah, I mean, it's a novelty when we see some of these things on other phones. But yeah, as soon as Samsung does something, it's going to be considered that all Android phones do it.
Well, I mean, the pop-up camera to us was a novelty until just this week, if you think about it, because the only phones that we'd heard of with these pop-up cameras were from Vivo and Oppo, which are not sold in North America. So immediately to us and our market, OnePlus legitimized that feature. And then 3 days later, we have the Asus Zenfone 6 with the same thing, which will also be sold in North America with a similar thing.
Similar type of thing, but yeah, much crazier to see happen anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I like it. I mean, one thing that if you haven't checked out yet, we'll have a link in the description in the show notes. Asus, alongside the Zenfone 6, also gave us a sneak peek at its concepts for the Zenfone 6 series. And some of them are pretty out there. Like, you know, they ended up using a flip-out camera, which is also pretty out there. But I mean, woof. Like, some of these are really interesting.
Yeah, this top one where, like, the whole, like, a considerable amount of the top of the phone flips out in, like, a big square chunk or slides up. There's some real, and then, of course, some really svelte, like, cool, futuristic-looking ones that could never happen.
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting was, and it was actually leaked by Evan Blass last year, I think, it was the dual slider. So depending on what you wanted to use it for, you could have the cameras exposed up top, or you could have a secondary display down on the bottom. Mm. And you could use it in either configuration depending on what you needed it for. That never came to be, and clearly Asus realized that it was going to be a usability disaster. But I don't know. I mean, they've been messing around with some weird things, and I wonder, every single manufacturer must have just labs full of these discarded concepts.
And, oh yeah, I'm looking at the GIF now of that dual slider thing. Yeah, that just does not seem like a
good idea.
I mean, and they always introduce such crazy ergonomic challenges, and you're right, for as many as we see leaked or shown off in any, you know, kind of respect, there are 50 times that many sitting in a lab somewhere, you know, that made it to various stages of production before they found out or decided that it wasn't going to be the right thing to do. And that's something to think about when we talk about all these phones. I mean, look, we've said the same thing. All these phones look the same. You could pick up a OnePlus 7 Pro and hand it to somebody and they'd think it's a Samsung phone. There's not a lot of differentiation there, but it's not for a lack of trying. These companies are doing these things. It's just they hit a lot of very serious roadblocks along the development pipeline.
Yeah, and it's just not worth the investment at some point. So yeah, I like that. I mean, we've even OnePlus last year showed off some unexplored 6T color variants that, you know, the that were very close to the Nebula Blue that ended up in the final OnePlus 7 Pro. So you can see like the gears turning well before the final product comes out.
Mm-hmm. And generations in advance too.
Totally. Oh yeah. I mean, we talk about the Galaxy Fold having manufacturing problems. They're much like, there's no question that they are hard at work on the second and probably even the third generation of Galaxy yep. Fold phones, because they have to be. These things take so long to develop. We take for granted that when a phone gets announced, it's going to come out in a couple of weeks, but that's 9 months, 9 to 18 months of like heads down planning and R&D. You know, you also like you discovered that the Pixel 3a was likely delayed at least 2 months just by yep. small discoveries that you made on the phone itself.
And it was probably, you know, physically as a phone ready to go in like early January.
Totally. Yeah.
You know,
so we still don't know why it was delayed, but we know that when it was announced on May 7th, it was put on sale May 7th. They had enough yeah. inventory that had probably been sitting there for a couple of months. And they're like, okay, makes more sense to do it at our next big keynote, which happens to be May 7th. And it's weird, like just to go talk about the Pixel 3a for a second. When it launched, there have been two sides of the argument, right? That it's kind of like a Pixel 3 Lite, not nearly as good as people say it is. It's slow, it's clunky, it's plastic, whatever. You know, they're really, really leveraging the camera to sell this thing. All the marketing around the Pixel 3a has to do with its camera for the price, the fact that you get night sight on a $399 phone. And on the other side of it, it's like, this is a really, really interesting long-term strategy for Google, and one that I think will pay off for them very, very well in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the staggered release being a little weird, but this type of strategy, similar to Samsung's, but you know, obviously a bigger price gulf, is what they need to do. The only question is, you know, do they tighten up the release timelines or not?
Okay, so we're going to take a second quick break and talk about our next sponsor, our friends Wix. You know, I've talked about Wix basically every week on this show for a few months now. They are a fantastic, fantastic way to make a website. You know, we work for a company that builds websites, custom websites with like very heavy heavily, you know, customized backends built on CMSs that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. We have dedicated tech teams. But Andrew, if you and I were told, hey, launch your own website tomorrow, if Android Central is going independent, I wouldn't even know where to start. I haven't coded in HTML since 2003.
No, we would have no idea. And even if we thought we had an idea, we would screw it up really, really quickly.
So, you know, Wix is a really good option for you if you have a business, if you have a portfolio, if you have anything that you need to put yourself out there. Wix is the place to go for it, to build that website. Over 140 million people use it to build their website. And you can actually publish for free. You don't have to pay anything. You do have to pay to upgrade to get that premium service, but we have a really good deal for you if you're interested in it. And you don't have to start from scratch. They have over 500 templates that work really well for whatever you're doing. If you want to show off your photos or video, if you want to launch a restaurant website to showcase your menu, to get to allow people to make reservations, you can do that really easily. If you're doing surveys, or if you're just hosting video, if you just want people to see what you've put together, you can do that really easily with Wix. There are full business solutions. So you can sell things using their e-commerce backend. You can host music. You can host events. You can do basically anything you want using their Wix builder. And if you want to get started, you can go to wix.com/podcast to get 10% off, which is a really great deal. So I highly recommend doing that. Going to wix.com, that's wix.com/podcast to get 10% off your premium plan, where you can create your own professional website, you can grow your business, and you can just be happy with your with yourself out there on the internet, because the internet sucks in a lot of places, but Wix does not. And we're really appreciative of their support of the show. Okay, final thing we want to talk about, Andrew, is 5G, Huawei, and just all this stuff that is going on. This week, President Trump signed an order that, quote, protects U.S. network infrastructure from foreign adversaries, and highlighted Huawei specifically in this. So walk us through exactly what happened with this executive order and the implications for companies like Huawei.
So the biggest thing about the order is that it's extremely broad, as executive orders tend to be. And in this case, it doesn't specifically target any one type of infrastructure, one type of network, one country or company. It really just leaves the door wide open, which, you know, if you're a specific company, then you're like, you know, phew, they didn't go after me exactly. But it has this massive chilling effect where anybody, any company, any country could be put under an extreme amount of scrutiny. And the way that they're, I guess, the stick that they're using in this case is they're using the financial side of it, and they're using the Commerce Secretary to be able to just block business deals and acquisitions of equipment involving U.S. companies or deployments in the U.S. when the other party is any foreign country. So anybody at this point can be deemed an adversary, and they can be put through this extra scrutiny where the government can block an otherwise above board, you know, out in the open deal because they don't think that it's going to, or rather they think that it's going to lead to further insecurities in U.S. infrastructure. And you can't really argue that the network and other infrastructure in the U.S. is not completely secure. I mean, we know that it's not secure. The question is, how much is this really going to help? It's really tough to prove the negative of something not happening as a result of, you know, this kind of policy.
So my question is, with what happened with ZTE last year, where they were specifically barred from any dealings with U.S. companies based on allegations that they contravened sanctions against Iran by selling them equipment. They were not allowed to, for a short amount of time at least, make any deals with U.S. companies or purchase any products from U.S. companies, which precluded them from working specifically with Google on Android and with Qualcomm on their Snapdragon and other chips that ZTE relies on for their smartphones.
And that's something that companies could be looking at right now.
Exactly.
Is those two in particular, Google and Qualcomm.
So, you know, Huawei, if they are barred from working with those same companies, they have a problem. They don't make, they make their own chips, so they rely much less on Qualcomm, but they do still have a vested interest in working with Google, at least in North America and Europe, where all of the Google software that runs on Huawei products goes through the CTS, the compatibility testing suite that Google requires OEMs to go through to get certified for Play services. In China, where Android is not does not go through that same scrutiny. It's open source and you can put whatever app store you want on there. But potentially Huawei could be in some really, really big trouble when it comes to its phones, even though this is mainly targeting its network equipment.
Yeah, and again, that's kind of the problem. It's ostensibly about infrastructure, but you can easily expand it. They really didn't limit it to the point where it's only talking about, you know, towers and routers and switches and things like that. It can easily be expanded to hit any amount of technology or specific components. In the case of something like Qualcomm, they could shut down being able to get specific audio chips or radio chips or anything like that, because they can deem that, you know, it's basically a punitive move in that case. Whereas obviously the infrastructure talk is, you know, there's a very real possibility that by allowing these deals to come through, especially in the foreign company selling things to the US direction, you know, arena, but they can expand this out to just be, you know, just as leverage to say, well, it would be a shame if something happened to your handset business you got there.
I mean, not only does this have implications on the relationship between the US and China, you know, this is the US barring companies in general, not specifying Chinese companies, but it'll have implications on Chinese companies like Huawei. This may have an impact on the US relationship with China, especially while they're trying to get a trade deal done. Chinese carriers are extremely aggressive in rolling out 5G right now, and companies like Huawei and ZTE are at the backbone of those networks, and those companies are completely barred from being used in the US for the same thing.
And, you know, kind of a mixed bag elsewhere around the world as well. And that really cuts into the, I mean, it makes everything more expensive for them when they can't continue to sell this equipment elsewhere and recoup more and more of that R&D cost.
Right. And Huawei's claim to fame, so to speak, about its network equipment is that it was much cheaper than the competition from Ericsson or Nokia or Cisco. And you know, even though there have been accusations that as a result of that relatively inexpensive equipment, you get it's not as secure. There's been no evidence shown that the network equipment itself has been vulnerable to hacking.
And part of the way that you see that this order is written is kind of like, we know that the infrastructure is insecure just because we don't know that it is secure.
Right.
You know, it's
a double negative.
It's the known unknowns,
right,
part. And so that's kind of the trouble of this kind of order as well, is they don't know what they're targeting or what they need to fix. They just know that it's not right. And so they're giving themselves a tool to be able to block something if it comes to be that they find out that there's a specific issue that they need to address and stop.
So all this is going on while the first 5G phones are launching in the US.
Download speeds, speed tests.
And that gives us all this data around whether it's actually going to be worth investing in these first generation 5G phones. So this week specifically, the Galaxy S10 5G launched in the US. It's at Verizon exclusively for a few weeks. We're not sure how long. Before it rolls out to the other four carriers. And it's only, and the 5G service is only available in two cities right now, Chicago and Minneapolis, and only available in very, very small parts of those two cities. Our colleague Hayato Huseman was in Chicago yesterday doing tests with the 5G network on the Galaxy S10 5G and said that the improvements over just a few weeks ago when he went to Chicago to test the 5G Moto Mod on the Moto Z3 are considerable. I mean, we were getting speeds of almost 1.5 gigabits down yesterday, which is pretty staggering.
Yeah, it's obviously there are all the standard, you know, caveats about it being early and so, you know, so on and so on. But it seems like it was not only dramatically faster, but much more consistent. Like, we know that there are just a handful of cells there and they know specifically where to go to show you how it works. But it already seemed so much more consistent just, you know, in the areas around those cells, which bodes pretty well for it. What we don't know is obviously how it works when you have thousands and thousands and thousands of people coming on and off these towers, or I should say small cells in this case. You know, obviously you just have, you have more bandwidth. 5G can handle more users coming and going quickly, grabbing large amounts of data and moving on better than LTE ever could. But you still, you know, the network still has to be built out properly.
Right. And then on the almost the flip side of the infrastructure conversation, where Verizon's using millimeter wave, Sprint is launching its 5G network this month in four cities, and they are doing it almost entirely on 2.5 gigahertz frequencies, which is
so-called sub-6.
Sub-6, and it's much closer to what we currently use with LTE. Lower capacity, but travels much further. You should be able to get signal indoors without much of a problem. And
in Sprint's case, they're just piggybacking on their LTE towers. They just put up the new things and they're done.
Right. So the investment is not nearly as big, but it's also why Sprint is so desperate to merge with T-Mobile, because they don't have the millimeter wave or the 700 megahertz spectrum that T-Mobile has. And in order to build out a comprehensive 5G network, they need all of it. They need the high, they need the low, the mid, and the low. And they have some of it, some of all of it, but not nearly as much as they as T-Mobile. They have mostly 2.5 gigahertz. So it's really interesting to see who is putting 5G at the center of their marketing. Clearly, Verizon is going heaviest right now. But we are still, like, we haven't heard a peep out of AT&T, even though they are using the same technology as Verizon.
Yeah, I mean, God, aside, it's annoying because I want to applaud AT&T for holding off, but then they haven't because they're still running 5GE commercials all over TV, and that annoys me.
Right. 5G, actual 5G on AT&T will be called 5G Plus, because of course it will.
Yep.
Okay, so there's that. There's the whole, should you even invest in a 5G phone yet?
And conversation. What an investment.
And that's an investment because these phones are expensive. The Galaxy S10 5G starts at $54 a month, which is $1,300 for the 256 gigabyte model. It's $1,400 or $58 a month for the 512 gigabyte model. You think the Galaxy S10 Plus is a big phone? This is a honker.
Does it weigh more than the OnePlus 7 Pro? It's close.
I think it does. I'm going to pull up the specs right now. Hang on.
Because it is slightly, I know it's slightly larger than the S10 Plus in every dimension, but I can't.
Yeah, I don't have the dimensions and the weight in front of me, but the Galaxy S10 Plus in ceramic is 198 grams. So I'm guessing this is more like 200, 210.
My goodness. Either way, it's gigantic. And that price
is also gigantic. Yep. Just to give you a bit of a refresher, the Galaxy S10 5G isn't just a Galaxy S10 Plus with 5G. It actually has a bigger 6.7-inch display. It's got 256 gigabytes of storage standard. It does not have a micro SD slot. It does not have 12 gigs of RAM. It has only 8 gigs of RAM. Doesn't matter which variant you get. And it has a fourth rear camera, which is a time of flight sensor. And it has a third front camera, which is also type of the time of flight. So you get everything you get with the S10 Plus, plus its time of flight sensor, plus obviously 5G.
Yeah. And so is this where we throw in the nobody should buy a 5G phone yet?
Oh, hey, hang on. There's more. You get a 4,500 milliamp hour battery. Oh, wait, there's more. And for some reason, it wasn't included in the S10 series, something called super fast charge, which is 25 watt charging. So I hate the fact that the S10 series doesn't have it, because the OnePlus 7 Pro has 30 watt charging, the Huawei P30 has 40 watt supercharging, and yet you're still stuck with 15 watts on the Galaxy S10, which is so stupid.
Correct.
But whatever. So yeah, please continue. Tell people not to buy this.
Well, I mean, you hit on it in that you're talking about parts of two cities for Verizon and parts of four cities, or, you know, larger parts, but slower speeds on Sprint. And so even if you live in one of those cities, you're not even going to see it all the time. And it's of dubious consistency and quality right now. And so that's kind of all you really need to know. On top of, you know, it would be one thing if you had this great variety of devices, but we're talking about like one phone or two phones, and they have their own compromises in being, you know, gigantic and expensive and things like that. It would be a different discussion if we were talking about the OnePlus 7 Pro and the Galaxy S10 and the Pixel 3 XL, and you could kind of just choose between them based on their own merits, and they all had 5G, and okay, you'd get 5G later. No, you have to go out of your way to get a 5G phone right now, and the problem is that benefit just doesn't come back to you. There isn't even really enough novelty to it. It's really just all downsides.
And the less we say about the LG V50, the better. So
yeah, better for everybody.
Better for everybody. So yeah, I mean, we'll talk a lot about 5G in the next few months. I think it's really important that we do discuss what's happening in this very fast growing, at least from a, you know, from a mind share perspective, it's fast growing. I wouldn't say it's going to be fast growing from an actual market share perspective until the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020. But this is exciting. It's exciting. It's expensive. And you get a lot of compromises as a result. So stay tuned for that. I think there's going to be a lot of cool stuff to talk about.
Yeah, it's 5G is very exciting, but it's not an exciting go out to the store and buy it yet stage.
All right, so we're going to end things there. We had aimed for 45 minutes before the show, and it's now an hour 20. So we never hit our targets. Unless you're looking for a longer show, and then of course
we hit the target.
So you're welcome, I guess. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have feedback, please send it to podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. Last week I asked you about whether you like gestures and which gestures you like. I had a bunch of people tell us that they absolutely hate the pill gestures in the Pixel 3 and they love OnePlus's take on it. A few people told me that they love Huawei's take on it, which is closer to the new Android Q than any other OEM. And others said that they hate it and they want it to die in a fire. Sorry for those of you who hate it. That's what's going to be your default for the next few years. So yeah, let us know what you think of all this 5G nonsense podcast@Android Central. We'd love to hear from you. Andrew, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me writing about all kinds of things at androidcentral.com, but less just tech is my Twitter account @AndrewMartinik, MARTONIK.
Less tech, unless it's the technical side of MLS soccer.
Yes, or cars and all kinds of things.
Bringatrailer.com.
Bring a trailer. Yep, there's a Gull Wing for sale right now.
It's over $1 million already. I'm still holding out for your podcast with David Ruddick. I think that'll be a fantastic addition to the canon.
His interest in that podcast is fleeting.
Yeah, as it is mine as well. All right, my name is Daniel Bader. Thank you so much for listening. You can find me at Journey Dan, and you can find us at Android Central. Check us out on Instagram, please, if you haven't followed us there yet. It's a great place to check out what we're doing on a daily basis. Our stories are kept up to date. If you missed us at the OnePlus 7 Pro launch event, check out our highlight. We have all of the details and all the fun from there. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
So long.